The subject of transcendentalism has many interpretations, and I can only give you the one that most appeals to me. There are two general approaches to the subject. One is academic and the other is non-academic. The academic phase is expounded by such thinkers as René Descartes, and the non-academic by the American transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson. So we have two schools, one founded in an academic approach and the other in a mystical approach. Now, in my mind, the academic approach is false to the subject for one reason. You cannot make an academic approach to mysticism. It is itself a conflicting approach to the subject under consideration. Transcendentalism has been described as a philosophical and religious democracy. It approaches things not from the standpoint of authority, but of internal enlightenment. According to Buddha, who was in this phase of the subject definitely a transcendentalist, the individual must work out his own way of life. His directives must come from within himself. He cannot be completely under the leadership of an authoritarian religion. In other words, he cannot continue to exist within a pattern of dogmatic religious institutionalism. He does not wish to be told by some intermediary what deity wants for man. Then the Ambises entered into the presence of the great Olympian temple. The priests came out to say to him, "We are the servants of this temple. What can we do for you?" And the conqueror said, "Whose house is this?" And the priest said, "This is the house of God." Then Cambyses says, "Man, step aside." And he went in alone. Now this, in a sense, expresses a metaphysical point of view. It is a point of view based definitely upon the inner experience of reality, that each person is constantly under the guidance of his own inner life. If he is early in the path of wisdom and does not have a very solid foundation, then the guidance from inside is gentle. If he is further advanced and becomes inconsistent with his own principles, then the guidance becomes more severe. And if he wanders too far from the paths of integrity, the guidance becomes dictatorial almost. But it is from himself. It is from the fact that within his own soul, the individual has the leadership of his life. Now, this presents a number of interesting questions, some of which are not easily answered. First of all, we must say that from within the individual, there is a constant stream of impulses coming through into the personality. These impulses are not all right or all good. And the concept that everything that comes from the inside is good and everything from the outside is bad simply cannot be sustained by experience. The individual's release of his own internal guidance depends upon a series of preparatory disciplines. And now we can think in terms of the Neoplatonists of Alexandria and Athens. In other words, we can only bring out or bring through that which we can dominate by our own integrities. The beginning, therefore, of the inner or mystical experience of life is and must be self-discipline. Self-discipline, in this case, is not based upon an arbitrary theological point of view. This discipline is the moderation of personal conduct. It is the individual gaining gradual mastery over little things, the daily experiences of living. Discipline is not a magnificent theological adventure. Discipline is a daily, arduous preservation of principles. Unless the individual has attained discipline, he cannot depend upon the internal pressures of consciousness. He cannot take the soul guidance he needs unless he has made possible the natural and normal expression of the soul power through his daily life. If his outer living is incorrect, if he is in his daily existence inconsistent with soul principles, he then can be deceived by a variety of pressures that come not from the soul, but from the misapplication of his own mental and emotional functions. Emotion has become consistently identified with soul power, but many emotions are not soul-centered. They do not arise in the soul. They arise in environment or the appetites of the individual. Therefore, many emotions are selfish, self-centered, destructive. They come from within, but they are not soul-centered. The individual, however, cannot be liberated from the inside out. He must begin by preparing his outer life to receive the true light of soul power. He must therefore overcome the hazards which will destroy or restrict the function of the soul factor. If he has a bad temper, it is a mistake to assume that an abstract spirituality will cure this. If he is selfish, he cannot simply proceed in spite of it. He cannot hope that soul power will overcome his selfishness. He must overcome it himself before the power of the soul can function through him. He must prepare the way. He must cleanse the inside of his own cup. He must do those things in daily life which remove from his daily activities those circumstances which prevent the natural expression of the good within himself. Consequently, we find most mystics who are really serious and do really want to have a breadth of understanding, living very simple lives. One of the great transcendentalists of the 17th century was Jacob Behme the shoemaker. He continued to peg shoes to the end of his life. He never made any effort to become superior, to dominate other people, or to found a sect or a cult. He shared his knowledge with a few friends, and it was not until after his death that his teachings gained general recognition. It is the same in nearly all mystical circumstances. There is no doubt in the world that St. Francis de Assisi was a transcendentalist. He was one who was moved from within himself rather than moved by the church hierarchy which dominated his physical existence. Therefore, we may say, in a sense at least, that Buddha was correct when he speaks of the universe as a cosmotheism. In other words, he tells us that existence itself is a cosmic democracy. It is not an autocracy. It is not a divine power ordering all things and human beings simply obeying. In other words, God is not a dictator. God is not pressing the individual against his own will, because the moment a person moves apart from his own will, he is no longer actually expressing himself and can take no credit for virtues that are forced upon him, even if he can practice them. But in most cases, he cannot practice them. If virtues are imposed by theology or by law, the individual secretly disobeys them. He continues in his own way, hoping that an organization or an institution or a policy can bestow the spiritual growth that he feels he requires. So in this point of view, each individual is in a sense the master of his own life. If he is not the master of his own life, then he cannot be held responsible for his actions. A person pressed to do that which he does not believe to be right is not responsible for the consequences if he has made every effort that is possible to himself to continue in a proper course of action. Cosmotheism in Buddhism is simply the realization that there are two forms of government, autocracy and democracy. Most systems of theology are autocratic, whereas mysticism and transcendentalism are actually democratic. They allow the individual to realize that when he achieves something worthwhile, the achievement is his. Basically, there is an endowment within him, which Emerson and most others have represented as being a divine capacity. The individual has within himself a spark of the infinite. He has within himself a principle, an energy, which enables him to unfold a destiny of his own. This destiny is, of course, conditioned and limited by the universe in which he exists. It is further conditioned by the environment into which he is born. He is not able to be a free agent completely, but he is able to have what Aquinas calls a limited individualism, a limited determinism, the right to choose between those things that he can choose between, that which is best for himself. But if he makes the choice himself, then it is his responsibility, his opportunity, and his consequence. If this choice is forced upon him by others, then the power to grow himself is frustrated. So we have in metaphysical transcendentalism the concept of the individual having the right, the inalienable right, to grow according to the dictates of his own conscience. He has a right to select that which is the greatest good for him. Now, it may well be that he is not able to make such a decision. He does not know what is good for himself. He does not know whether the things he wants are proper or improper. He does not know the difference between aspiration and ambition. He is not sure how much he should sacrifice of worldliness in order to attain a condition of inward enlightenment. These decisions he is not certain about. He is not aware of how far he can trust his own nature. The answer, of course, is that he can trust his own nature to a very great degree if he does not permit superficial and unimportant factors to dominate him. So the Greeks and the Egyptians placed disciplines upon the person, disciplines that were not intended to dogmatize, disciplines that were not given to him by a hierarchy in order to force virtue upon him, but disciplines to make him capable of the self-direction of his own life. One of the problems that nearly everyone has to struggle with is the difference between ambition and aspiration. Ambition is usually a very physical, very mortal type of pressure. Ambition makes us want to be a leader over others. Aspiration makes us want to be true to the self within us. Ambition, therefore, ends in worldly controls. Aspiration in the disciplines of inner life. One of the great illumines of the past pointed out definitely that one of the safeguards to prevent us from making the mistake between ambition and aspiration is to realize humility. Humility is the individual placing himself under the control of good, so far as he is capable of determining good. He is gradually invited to cast off the restrictions and limitations of his own negative attitudes. He is taught the importance of truthfulness, of gentleness, of service, and of cooperation. And he is warned against this desperate search for spirituality, which has been one of the great causes of man's material culture. He also has to realize that the obstacles to his growth are not primarily in his environment, but within himself. And it is man's personal environment, his body, his emotions, and his mental attitudes that must be organized, must be relaxed into a state of cooperation. In other words, he must gain the power to release soul in conduct, in daily relationship with people. He must learn to love the beautiful and serve the good. He must become unselfish. He must protect himself against all destructive attitudes. These things come first. Therefore, in the ancient mystery system, the whole concept was discipline. But the discipline was not to bring him under the authority of the temple or under the domination of the gods. The discipline was for the purpose of releasing his own divinity from within himself. And until the release is from the inside, no essential growth is possible. No one can grow for someone else, nor can someone else grow for him. Man cannot bestow enlightenment upon man. The only thing that the wise can do is invite the individual to control himself. Now, this is contrary to many of the precepts and doctrines which have dominated human life for thousands of years. We have depended almost entirely upon a few leaders to make our lives safe. We appoint representatives and expect them to express us. This is a materialistic fallacy. We probably cannot overcome it immediately, but no leader can save his following. The only thing he can do is invite his following to save themselves and to provide them the reasonable opportunities to express the boast of their own inner life. This being the case, the teacher is not one who gives the instruction primarily. He is only the one who gives the person a certain number of basic rules to live by, which, if followed intelligently and with dedication, will help the person to help himself. In a democracy, we must all grow. We cannot depend for our security upon the growth of one or two persons. We cannot elect a leader who can be a substitute for the leadership of our own inner life. Emerson, Thoreau, and several of the group of the New England Boston Transcendentalists were persons who had previously very orthodox religious backgrounds. But there was a gradual rebellion arising within them. Emerson rebelled against the domination of a more or less rigid clergy. And all over the world, people today are striving to rescue religion from theology. Theology was something in which religion served as an autocrat. Theology was what determined the individual's conduct by the will of an ecclesiastical hierarchy. In the Middle Ages, if he didn't conform, he was burned at the stake. There was not the intent to help him to release himself. He must obey a rule or a canon. He must do what he was told to do, and this rule or canon constituted integrity. If he disobeyed the rule or the canon, he was subject to a heavy penalty. Therefore, the decision was not because of his love of God, but because his fear of being burned at the stake. This was contrary to all basic religious insights and therefore caused a gradual rebellion leading ultimately to the Protestant Reformation. Actually, the Protestant churches, to a measure, have taken on this transcendentalism. There is less and less dogmatism in them. And in the groups such as the Friends, then the Quakers, we find an almost complete lack of ecclesiastical organization. In many of these groups, the individual allows whatever is his own highest conviction to come through. And he is satisfied to live with this and try to grow accordingly. There's much to be said for a very simple religious belief. And I think for most people it is the only security in these troubled times. There's been a great deal of emphasis upon finding shortcuts to enlightenment, using all kinds of escape mechanisms and defense mechanisms, and assume that these come from inside. We must realize, however, that a very great part of psychic phenomena arises, yes, from the inside, but not from the soul core. It arises from frustrations of one kind or another, escape mechanisms, defenses, and to a measure, hallucination. The actual problem, therefore, of growing is to settle down to the keeping of the rules. And these rules are not difficult, and as one philosopher observed not long ago, namely, the history is the great example of keeping and breaking rules. And wherever the rules of human relationships are broken, history becomes violent. Wherever the individual follows the best part of himself, he comes to the nearest security that he can attain in this world. So here we have the definite problem of weeding out what constitutes, to most people, information from inside. They want to believe that dreams or visions or symbols or some mysterious arrangement of psychic pressures is very important. It is only important if the individual who receives it is already a well-organized individual. In other words, the visions of a neurotic are not trustworthy, regardless of how we want to think about it. Also, in a great many cases of frustration, dreams are merely a statement symbolically of the frustration and not a cure for it. And in most cases, these pressures, these visions, these messages are aimed at making the mistake important and telling the individual that he's right and other people are wrong. If he's wrong himself, he will try to escape just as he would in ordinary physical living. If he wants to escape the responsibility of admitting that he is wrong, he goes into an elaborate defense of his own attitudes or tries to push the responsibility onto someone else. Now, the mind and emotions do the same thing. The mind, when cornered with a mistake, fights to defend it or to transform it or to transfer it to someone else. The curing of the mistake is not part of the attitude. In our daily living, a person who is subject to excessive temper fits is not nearly as interested in correcting these attitudes as he is in trying to prove that other people are responsible for his bad disposition. It is not that he has a bad disposition, but that other people irritate him beyond his control. This has been explained so many millions of times, also thousands of times from the psychologist's couch, that there is no question of what it means. The person is trying desperately to be right, even when he is thoroughly wrong. To get to understand this thorough wrongness is not easy, but nature does its best for us at all times. Because each of us has an individual relationship with life, if we pervert these qualities of our own natures, various hurts and disappointments come in. The individual with a bad disposition ultimately has to live alone. The individual who breaks all the good rules and habits of health gets sick earlier than those who are a little better organized. Individuals who determine to lock themselves in their own ideas pass through life with practically no growth of any kind and have simply wasted 70 or 80 years of their own time and the taxpayers' money. Actually, unless the individual grows, he has no reason to be here. And the individual does not grow because he's already right. He is not here because he is perfect. Here again, Buddha pointed out a very important purpose. We're not here because we're right. We're here because of the unfinished business in ourselves. And we will be back as long as the business remains unfinished. And the individual trying to escape responsibility, trying to have a life of fun, depending upon bad habits for his pleasures, and devoting himself entirely to the accumulation of worldly goods in a universe where these are of no importance whatsoever, does not have a good life. Now, you say, for instance, that they come to me frequently and they bring the name of a dozen teachers and ask me which one's authentic. The one that's authentic is the one inside, if you give it a chance. Now, if someone comes along and says, I can help you to reach into yourself by discipline, you might have a little confidence in them. But if that confidence is to remain, they have to do that very, very thing. And in these days of highly competitive metaphysics, the emphasis is nearly always on making everything as easy as possible for the follower so that he will not search elsewhere and will remain. It is not the basic intention of these things to make life strictly correct. The individual who has a bad disposition can go through all kinds of religious organizations and still have it. Nothing has been done to make him change. Now, you can't point a finger at him and say, change. This would probably result in a riot. But what you can do is to recognize that anyone who is a fit leader is gently but firmly impelling you to change. Not compelling, but impelling. The sincere leader wants to liberate a follower, not to attach him. He wants the individual to grow into his own fullness, or as far as he can go. It is not likely that he's going to develop all his potentials in any one embodiment, but he should leave this world better than he gets into it. And the only way he can be better is because he has released more of good from within himself. It is this good from within himself that helps him to grow. Now, in order to increase this probability of good and encourage growth, man is faced with responsibility. His life is very often a mass of duties. He is continually being beset by situations that are difficult. So these become, in a sense, his trials, his tests, his obligations. The reason why he is beset with these difficulties is because he has not handled situations correctly. The situation that is difficult arises usually from his own inability to handle something that might have been good. Nature does not send false evils to us. Nature does not afflict us with anything that is beyond our comprehension to work with and finally to normalize. We are not simply being beaten by some strange cosmic force that wishes to bear down on us until we can't stand it any longer. All of these things require certain adjustments within ourselves. And mysticism in general teaches the importance of adjustments, the importance of making things what they should be through a gradual process of enlightenment. The moment a problem arises, we have to estimate our own resources. Whatever we are, whoever we are, and whatever the problem is, the answer is in ourselves. Of this there can be no doubt. Whatever situation that we face can be dominated by our own inner convictions. We can solve any problem in one of several ways. Now, here's another situation that arises. The individual, wishing to solve a problem, decides for himself how that solution must be attained. He knows what the solution is that he wants. But as Pythagoras says, every man knows what he wants, but only God knows what he needs. Therefore, in an effort to achieve a solution, we think in terms of comfort, release from responsibility, pleasure, or profit. Whereas nature is interested in achievement, in the strengthening of the internal resources of the person. Actually, if we look around ourselves, we will find that we live in a world in which certain dictatorial attitudes have become prevalent. Nations, leaders of all degrees and all magnitudes, are attempting to control each other. We wish to dominate a world politically, economically, scientifically, socially, religiously. The difference between a great political movement and a great religious movement is only the particular fact or form of domination that each exercises. It is not our comfort or our happiness or our growth that is the final consideration. Somebody wants to govern other people, wants to control them, exploit them, use them, and if necessary, destroy them if they have refused to obey. This is a wrong attitude to begin with. And therefore, as long as nations or individuals dominate in this way, the tragedy will never end. It is not the domination of another, but the direction of ourselves that is the reason for evolution as far as man is concerned. So when you start in with this problem, you begin by assuming one point, which we all have to have faith in something. Faith is the beginning of effort. Faith is that attitude in ourselves that is supported by the highest traditions of the race, the greatest experiences of the past, and those things held most sacred and dear to our own hearts and souls. Faith, therefore, must have a proper integration, a proper point of view. There are two forms of faith that are important to us. One is faith in universal integrity, and the other is faith in the possibility of personal self-unfoldment. If the individual believes that the universe is honest, then there is no longer any reason for his own dishonesty. If he believes that there is within himself a divine spark or a flame or a light, then he has the faith to do something about it. So faith is the acceptance of an honorable hypothesis. Faith is something that must be accepted first and proven by experience later. If our faith is wrong to start with, we can be very embittered and more likely to blame the religion we belong to or the world we live in. But faith is basically the individual's acceptance of a law of universal love and justice. With this in the back of the mind, he can also gain a great example from history. History is the proof of faith. It has been said that the Christian Bible is the basis of a great hope for mankind, of mankind. And it is a book of faith strengthening. It doesn't tell you all the things you want to know. In fact, tells you very little. But it strengthens your realization or belief that there is a good, that there is a reason for self, that there is a destiny toward which we are all laboring with varying degrees of success. But faith begins in the term of mysticism by simple recognition that the individual can grow and can accomplish all good that is necessary to himself. Also, that this faith is best manifested through a complete pattern of unselfish dedication to principles. That the individual also, in the process of learning, must learn, as many have in the course of years, that the most important of all religious exercises is service. The individual who forgets himself comes nearer to his own soul. The individual who is always thinking of himself and his own rights, his own privileges, and his own abilities is usually not internally enlightened. It is the forgetting of self in the fulfillment of the law that brings us closer and closer to inner potential. Actually, according to Emerson, and I think this is equally true of the other schools, Neoplatonism, as it is found in Athens, in Proclus, and in Alexandria through Plotinus, Iamblichus, and other great Neoplatonists, these teachers took a theology that had descended to them from Plato, principally, and they gradually adapted it to a complete dedication to the highest possible concepts of human life. They were the ones who emphasized most of all the tremendous importance of simple sincerity in the strengthening of the spiritual life. Most of these people were philosophers and had philosophical backgrounds. But philosophy is a very broad term. Philosophy does not necessarily mean one of the schools such as we know today. Most of these schools now at loggerheads with each other. It does not mean a sheer intellectualism in which we try to rationalize ourselves into a state of grace. Philosophy is nothing more or less than organized idealism. It is the individual using the inner values of his own life to create what he calls common sense. Common sense is simply the most natural and most obviously correct way of directing a life. Common sense is the most uncommon of all sensory perceptions, but it arises when the individual begins to cast off superficial and, for the most part, impossible or irrational hypotheses and settles down to the common circumstances of life. Common sense has been likened to childhood because in the early years of life, the individual has not been spoiled. And what we call growing up is largely the destruction of our own inner lives. Not destruction in the sense of a final annihilation, but the prevention of these inner values from coming through. Children, and small children especially, are normally friendly, kindly, and affectionate. They are trusting. They believe in things. And it is only when they are gradually educated out of their own faith that we have more and more trouble with them. We have, in the metaphysics, especially in mysticism, the quiet way, the way of peaceful growth through the acceptance of responsibility, through a quiet fulfillment of all duties, and for a complete control of our own attitudes. Mysticism, by quieting the inner life, by taking away from it all the pressures and inconsistencies and absurdities with which we burden it, allows the truth to come through. In other words, it is another statement of what it says in the Bible, "Be still and know that I am God." If we are quiet enough in the outer life, the inner life comes through. We hear the voice of the silence. We hear the gradual revelation of the nobility within ourselves, not as words, but as very quiet values and strength, and an increasing courage to keep the rules. In the transcendentalist system of thinking, the mystical experience, or the experience of man's relationship to deity, is not something that comes as a reward for a specialized training. It is a reward simply for the life of virtue, what Confucius calls the life of the superior person, the person who is so integrated in himself that he is incapable of being over-influenced by the corruptions of his environment. The gentle person, completely relaxed, but not negative, is the one in whom the soul power or the inner life has the greatest possibility of manifesting itself. One thing, of course, that most people have gotten into trouble with is the conflict between the ego and the soul. The ego, or the I am, me and mine, does not represent the true self. It has been demonstrated in nearly all systems of learning, mysticism, psychology, and religion, that the ego is a false god. The ego is simply the superficial summary of undigested experiences and unenlightened attitudes. The ego is a kind of self. It is the self that says, gimme, I want, I must have. The type of ego is that which tears down others to build up self. Ego has concern with riches, wealth, social standing, and very often with dissipation. The ego is a personal self allowed to dominate the impersonal self locked within it. The ego is the superficial outside of the human personality. It is that which most commonly dominates conduct and therefore most commonly mutilates conduct. The difference between the ego and the soul is that the ego lives in this world, thinks in terms of it, expects nothing beyond it, and wants to build into this material existence every satisfaction that is conceivable. There is no long-range plan, because to the ego there is no long range. There is simply the immediate comfort, whether it be by dissipation or by damaging other people. The ego is the source of crime. It is the source of practically every delinquency of the individual. These delinquencies arising from various negative attitudes or from the simple desire to succeed without effort. The individual who does not want to earn what he has and tries to take it some other way is a victim of his own ego.